Welcome to Trial Lawyer View, the podcast dedicated to the fierce yet compassionate lawyers who fight every day for justice in the courtroom. Our guests are top trial lawyers and their firms who share their stories and experiences, offering valuable insights into their journey, as well as expert guests who provide actionable strategies and practical tips for personal injury lawyers looking to optimize their operations, enhance client service, and drive growth in their practices. Trial Lawyer View is brought to you by Synergy. At Synergy, we aren't just a service provider. We are a strategic partner for personal injury law firms, seamlessly integrating with law firms to boost efficiency from day one. Outsourcing cumbersome administrative tasks like lien resolution and Medicare compliance to an expert partner like Synergy enables personal injury firms to focus on what they do best.
Welcome to the Trial Lawyer View podcast. Today, I'm thrilled to feature Jennifer Gore Cuthbert, a female leading personal injury attorney and the founder of Atlanta Personal Injury Law Group. With multiple locations throughout the metro Atlanta area, Jennifer and her dedicated team specialize in representing clients who've suffered injuries in auto accidents, trucking crashes, slip and fall incidents, and wrongful death. Known for her exceptional client service and innovative use of technology to streamline legal processes, Jennifer's firm has rapidly established itself as a leader in the personal injury space, emphasizing the importance of maximizing case value and effective communication. Since founding her firm in 2013, Jennifer has achieved remarkable success, leading to exponential growth in her firm. Her outstanding accomplishments in the legal profession have earned her numerous accolades, including the Avvo Clients' Choice Award and recognition as one of the National Trial Lawyers' Top 40 Under 40 Civil Plaintiff Lawyers. Her firm is one of the fastest growing companies in America, as evidenced by the firm's inclusion on the Inc. 5000 list. In addition to her legal achievements, Jennifer's passionate about giving back to her community, sponsoring scholarships and supporting local initiatives like the Backpack Project for students in need. As a co-author of Tiger Tactics CEO Edition, and a sought-after speaker, Jennifer shares her insights today on a variety of topics, including entrepreneurship, scaling and growing a personal injury firm, marketing and branding, and other topics of interest. Jennifer, thank you for joining me today, and welcome to Trial Lawyer View.
Thank you for having me. How are you?
I'm awesome. Awesome. I wanted to start out with a question about something that we have in common, which is being injured due to the negligence of someone else. I know from doing my research that you were involved in a pretty serious accident back in college, which kind of shaped your path. And I was struck by a car while cycling back in 2016. And I know how that can turn your life upside down. And had Daryl Isaac on the podcast recently, and he was also struck by a car while cycling. And it changed his understanding of what clients go through because of that experience. And I'm curious how you're able to use your personal experiences today in the way you interact with your clients, or even how you built your firm, if that's how it played into your future and how it shaped it.
Yeah. So can I ask you, when was your accident?
It was 8-2-2016. It's, you know, burned into my memory. It actually happened less than a mile from where I'm sitting right now, because my office is close to my home, and I was going out for a training ride with a group of guys and gals that I would cycle with every Tuesday and Thursday morning, and have been racing since I was a teenager. So I've been doing this a long time. It happened when I was 46. So I remember that morning very clearly, up until the time that I was knocked unconscious. And then I don't remember a lot after that for about 5 days afterwards.
Yeah, it's interesting. There are a ton of lawyers that I know that have been hit on a bicycle. I think Daryl was also on a bicycle when he was hit. I know a lawyer in Tampa that was hit on a bicycle. That's a pretty big trial lawyer. So if you're on a bike, be very cautious, because we've represented tons of people who've been run over. It's typically not the biker's fault. It's the fact that a lot of our roads are not really designed for biking. I was just in Paris, and I was looking at how the roads over there are designed and they're so accommodating to people on bikes. They have their own lanes. They're very protected. I just feel like it's kind of dangerous here in Georgia, at least, to ride your bike.
Florida, too. I got hit. I was in a bike lane when I got hit and literally landed on the bike lane symbol, and my blood pooled coming out from that. But literally, somebody took a picture at the scene of that, and it's such an ironic picture to me. Just
you were in no way in the wrong. And that's the thing about these accidents, is it doesn't come down to whether or not you're in the wrong. You still have to be the one that bears those injuries. So my accident was a long time ago. It was when I was like 20 years old, and I'm 40. So a long time ago, and in a different state of mind, it was the night before Thanksgiving, you know, when everyone kind of goes out and you're home, and I was going to pick up my sister and we were going to go out and celebrate. And I got into a head-on collision with a car, and there was also like a deer involved. There was just like a deer had like kind of darted out. It was a dark road, and then it caused this head-on collision. And my first reaction was like, I have no time for this. Like, that's a 20-year-old mindset. I am going places. I have places to go, and this is about to ruin my night. And I was so not actually in reality to the seriousness of the accident. When you're in an accident, I feel like you can bring yourself back to that moment. And I was alone in the car, and when the airbags deploy, there's this kind of smoke that goes through the car. And if you're unfamiliar with this, you could think that the car's on fire, which is what I thought. And so my immediate reaction was like to get out of the car. And the car was pretty severely damaged. And my cell phone had like flung out of wherever the holder was in the car. So I couldn't find my phone. And the biggest like shocker of the situation was I was like immediately like, let me get out of this car. And I couldn't move my legs. And I thought that was odd. And I was like, this is weird. I just feel like the car is kind of smoky from that airbag. And then I can't really move. I almost feel like the feeling is like you just feel like you got jerked around. You're just like in a bit of a state of shock. And because it was such a serious accident and there were so many cars, someone else had called, probably multiple people had called 911. And so they were coming and they had to cut me out of the car, because when you tell someone you can't move, like they want to take you out flat. And so they cut off all the doors. So the firemen are there with me. They have to like sit with you while they're cutting the doors off so they don't hurt you. And I was just aggravated. That's my only feeling. You know, I'm a 20-year-old college kid, and I'm like, someone's got to call my sister and say like, I'm not going. And my parents showed up to the scene while they were cutting the doors off, which probably was also not good. Then when they get you on the stretcher, you know, my memory is that they start cutting off all your clothes, which like really pissed me off. So I was like the worst patient ever. Like I was like, you're cutting off my clothes. Like there's people, it's like large volumes of people. I'm not bleeding. And I just was so combative, like I was horrible. I think about that now when we represent people and they're not taking their accident serious. Like I had a broken pelvis and I was like, I'm fine, you know? And so I have a lot of compassion for the people that we represent where they don't have time to be in an accident. It's highly disruptive to their life. They don't think that it's going to have long-standing consequences. Like I was this person, you know, and it took like 6 months of my life away from me because I had to go heal and I had to leave college. There was no online college at that time. And I remember the insurance company called me and was like, you know, normally we don't do this for people, but for you, we'll give you $2,000 and pay your bills. That's always what they say. We'll pay your bills and we'll give you $2,000. And I just remember thinking, this doesn't sound right. You know, like there's something inside of you that goes, this doesn't sound right. And, you know, that was kind of like the start of my personal injury journey. And I don't know if you have long-standing consequences. I'm sure you do. What are yours?
Well, actually, I have a dental implant done 2 weeks ago, and this is 8 years post being struck. My face hit the A-pillar of the truck, so it broke every bone in my face, broke my jaw in multiple places, knocked out seven of my teeth on the upper, and recently, where my jaw was broken, right at the midline fracture, one of my teeth died because of, you know, the trauma. So I had to have a dental implant done. So I don't have a final tooth there. It's actually a little shorter because he was worried about me putting any stress on the dental implant. So, you know, it's, and I broke my collarbone. So I've got a metal plate in my collarbone and had a, you know, mild TBI like Daryl. And, you know, for me, it was definitely life changing in a moment. And like you, I mean, I had places to go, people to see. I was, you know, was and is still CEO of the company and had my jaw wired shut for 3 months, you know, and then under dental reconstruction for a year and a half after that, couldn't eat normally for basically 2 years. So, yeah, and I mean, it's crazy.
You were already in the industry when this happened.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So 20 years, you know. And couldn't figure out, I mean, like down to our health insurance plan wouldn't cover all the dental reconstructive work because it was an ERISA plan and the ERISA provision said any dental trauma would only be covered if treatment was complete within 1 year of injury. Well, mine couldn't be, you know, so I was talking to friends I knew who were specialists in ERISA law. Hey, are there ways to fight this? Because even though I know ERISA law as it relates to lien resolution, didn't really know how that would play out, you know, in this instance with health insurance provision. And, you know, so it's very difficult navigating.
You know, I don't know about you, but I don't see myself as a victim. I struggled with that for a while because, like, I just don't see myself as a victim, even though a lot of bad things have happened to me in my life. Like, I think about it sometimes. Some people have asked me, well, just because you got an accident, why did you become a lawyer? Like, a lot of bad things can happen. Why do you decide to, like, take this on as a career? I did feel disempowered through the process, but I never felt like a victim just because I don't think I was raised to see myself as a victim. But there is a certain level of power and, like, knowledge that you get when you're a lawyer and you can navigate the system just as you were describing because you know things. And the average person does not know how to navigate these complex circumstances that personal injury cases present. And I feel like so grateful in some ways that these things happened to me because it drew me to become a lawyer. And then becoming a lawyer, you know, I feel like we have a lot of insight that other people don't have.
The one thing I talk about it being the best thing that ever happened to me for a lot of reasons, it just made me be more introspective, look at my life, look at where I was. And, but two, what it gave me was, and Daryl and I talked about this when we were discussing this topic, was just this deeper understanding of what people go through and what I've use that in a positive way is to every time we onboard a new team member here at Synergy, I walk them through what I went through and make them understand who they get the opportunity to serve and help, because that's the mission, is helping the injured parties and their families by protecting the net recovery from lien holders. Well, there is, you know, power in understanding the mission of who you're actually helping. And by personalizing the story, I think I get the opportunity to hopefully make an impact with our team. So if they're not empathetic because they haven't necessarily walked in those same shoes, they have compassion and they understand the importance of it. So I think that there's certainly, I don't look at myself as a victim. I obviously, you know, if I had to choose it all over again, I wouldn't get struck in the car.
It's such a catch 22 because it does transform your life. But if you could choose it, would you? Probably not.
Yeah, I would have rather something else shake up my life versus, you know, I was in the hospital 21 days and 9 days in the ICU, you know, medically induced coma for 5 days. So like all those things, you know, are things I don't think anybody wishes on anybody else. But particularly, I don't know about you, but I'm one of these people that likes to control what's going on. And then when you're in that, I mean, I couldn't even talk because I had tubes down my throat and my jaw was wired shut. And I just remember several times where they were suctioning because I was on a vent and not being able to say, hey, you're suctioning too long. You need to give me a chance to get a breath because I felt like I was choking to death. I mean, like little things like that, you're completely at the mercy of the foe. And I was in a ORMC, the trauma hospital here did an amazing job and they were great. But just that feeling of complete and utter loss of control of what's going on, even with your body in some of those circumstances.
Yeah, it's medical situations like are not my favorite. Try to do everything I can now to stay healthy so I don't have to be in a medical environment. But I do think, you know, it caused me to take my health very seriously. I have to work really hard to stay like in good health because we're more prone to other things once you've had serious injuries. So that's been, you know, something I take very seriously. Like if I had been paralyzed, my life would have been totally different, right? And I wasn't paralyzed, thank God. I think sometimes your body just goes into a protective state when you're injured, and I had a pelvic injury. But I don't know. I think like sometimes people say like, why are you so ambitious or so this or so that? It's like I had a near-death experience at a young age, you know?
Yeah, that's what I was wondering. And that's why I started with that question, just because I can't help but think that that's part of what shapes, you know, that drive. You get that another chance when you see something like that occur and what the impacts to you and how you walk away from that, I think, is it's partly what defines you as a person, right? You can either see yourself as a victim or you say, well, this happened to me. What good can I make come of it?
Let's get serious. Let's see where we can go now. Yeah. Because I'm here on borrowed time.
And I was always pretty serious, probably a bit like you, and very ambitious and very driven. But, you know, it just changes things, I think, a bit. That's why I did start with that. I wanted to ask you, though, a little bit about your past, because I had, in doing the research for the podcast, heard you talk about your parents being an entrepreneurial influence on your journey. And I'm wondering if you can talk about how that influenced and what lessons you've carried forward in leading one of the fastest growing women-led law firms and now on the Inc. 5000 list. So how did that all influence you to get to where you are?
Yeah, so I am originally from New York.
Me too.
And,
well,
yeah,
Brooklyn.
So my dad was born in the Bronx, but I grew up in Poughkeepsie, which is upstate on the river. But we are, you know, people of New York who see ourselves as, you know, the city is the center of the universe. And New York has that kind of entrepreneurial vibe. And my dad was just a natural born entrepreneur. He started his first company when he was 18. And he had many companies when I was a kid. He had a lot of like blue collar companies he ran. He had a travel agency. He owned real estate. He owned apartment buildings. He had a cleaning company. He had like so many different, he had an answering service in the 90s. He just had like, he had an office building where he had a bunch of different companies he ran within that. And so I grew up around that and he would take me to work with him. And I was his like oldest child and he never had a son. So I have all sisters. So I kind of was his little sidekick and I look like my dad. And, you know, he just, I think, took me under his wing. And so just my whole life, I didn't think anything that I experienced was different, but I have come to realize it was different because he would just tell me little like life lessons, like, just very entrepreneurial things when I was a child. And he would just say, like, when you grow up and you own your own company, like, that's just like a given, you know? So I am so grateful for him for that, because I believe a lot of your life is through your expectation of what's going to happen. And he set certain expectations in my mind at a really young age that I would be entrepreneurial. And I'm sure there's also like a DNA component that I'm very much like him in that way, because a lot of his friends will say, like, you're your dad 20 years ago. I just have that. I love business. I'm very drawn to business. I went to business school as a kid. I was a weird kid. I would always, like, I published my own, like, newspaper and delivered it to all the new neighbors. I used to put on, like, shows and productions and sell tickets to all these shows, and I would make all the kids, like, be in my shows, but I was, like, the director. So I was just, like, doing all kinds of, like, weird things and selling things. We used to make things and sell things. But that was very normal in my family, you know?
Yeah.
So
completely get it. Because I had a very similar experience. My parents actually moved from New York to Florida to start a business, and I watched them build it from scratch, nothing, to a very successful business. And so I completely understand, like, seeing the lessons, like watching them manage employees, deal with problems, because inherently every business has problems that you have to figure out ways to solve and overcome to continue to grow. And, you know, all of those things I watched and saw them, you know, work incredibly hard at that.
I will say that now, having run my own company for a while, my dad, I think, was good at what he did, but he would say, like, he didn't have access to the mentors that I have had, like, back in the 80s and 90s. Like, I think it was harder to find mentors and information because the internet was, like, at its infancy. And he always says to me, like, you've been able to go so much farther because, like, I am always, like, learning and going to some mastermind or finding some mentor or reading something. And, like, I just don't think my dad had a ton of mentors, and, like, you know, his business got to a certain point, but I think he, like, kind of stagnated. Like, he never really developed high level leaders in his company. And there was, like, problems that he encountered that I feel like I've been able to kind of, like, go to the next level with from the base that he gave me. And so much of my success has been because I am committed to continually learning and, like, finding mentors and people to help me.
Huge believer in that, and have leveraged that as much as I possibly can through organizations like YPO and Vistage and other organizations. But that access today to people that are mentors, advisors from a business,
coaches,
yeah, it is so incredibly important. I was actually going to ask you about that in terms of, you know, how you've leveraged those kinds of resources to build what you've built, and how important of a role did that play in getting to where you are today?
I mean, it's a critical skill to be able to find great mentors and coaches and get them to want to mentor you. I wasn't looking for mentors in the 90s, but I imagine it was much harder, you know, going to seminars and things. Now you can just go to a seminar on Zoom, you know, we're talking and you're probably in Orlando. I have, like, built an art around the idea of finding mentors. I show up to a lot of events. I find out about a lot of events, and I go and I try to meet people that I think are successful and ask them, will you help me? Like, point blank, will you help me? Will you be my mentor? And I think being bold and asking for help is, like, probably 80%.
Yeah, it's funny. My youngest daughter graduated from the University of Florida in May, was talking about just some of her dissatisfaction with what she was doing in her job. And we were talking about it over the dinner table and talking about, you know, seeking out a mentor within the organization to try and leverage what she can for this experience and getting ultimately to what she wants. And it's not just obviously about coaching, it's that mentorship as well. Did all that inspire you to establish Evergreen Coaching? Because I know you've now built this. I'm not sure if your coaching includes personal injury attorneys and what, or if it's just outside the personal injury realm.
Yeah, so I started going to business coaching my second year of owning Atlanta Personal Injury Law Group. And the reason I did it was because I had a friend here in Atlanta who was going to Miami, going to this coach, and she was growing really fast. And I was like seeing the writing on the wall. And I was like, you know what? I'm a very results-oriented person. She's now hired 5 more people than me, and like we were kind of on the same track. And I'm like, what's going on here? Where are you getting all these ideas? She's like, well, I'm going to this coach. I'm flying down there. I was like, you know what? I'm going to go check it out. I'm a very curious person. And my dad actually was like, you don't need a coach. He was like, you've got me, and you went to business school, and you're smart. And I was like, yeah, but like, what if I could go faster? And he went with me, and we went to this seminar, and they were like, you know what? If you want to sign up, it's $1,500 a month, and you have to sign up today, and it's like stressful. And I was like, I'm doing it. And I did it. And at that time, it felt like a lot of money. It's not a lot of money, but it felt like a lot of money. And especially in a new personal injury firm where, you know, the cash flow is like always tricky in the first year and a half. And I never looked back after that. When I do things, I'm pretty much like 100% or zero. And so every seminar that they had, I went and sat in the front row. And if anybody knows me and they see me at seminars, I only sit in the front row. I am like obsessive. I'm in the front row. I'm asking questions. I'm like, I have a question. And then they're like, well, we have like extra workshops you can go to learn how to do intake and to do HR and to do all these different things. And I was like, okay, so you're saying if I go to this workshop, you think I'll get better at intake? And so then I would just kind of like suddenly start going to everything they had. And I did that for like 5 years, and my firm grew exponentially. And they, you know, the promise of that program at the time was they could get you, you know, over 7 figures, which when you're starting out, you're like, this sounds great. I want to have a 7-figure law firm. But then when you really have a 7-figure law firm, you're like, this isn't actually a lot of money. You know, I did all that coaching. And then I got to this point where I was like, you know what, I really want to work with somebody who exclusively does personal injury, because there's a lot of business coaching programs that kind of teach you general business, how to sell, how to hire, how to build systems. But I then really wanted to go work with someone who does exactly what I do. And so that was my beginning of my journey to find coaches and mentors that were in the personal injury space. And so, you know, Daryl was one of my mentors. Mike was one of my mentors, still is. Chad Dudley is one of my mentors. I have like a bunch of Rex Paris has been a mentor. I've gone around the country and collected mentors, all different amazing people. And, you know, I've learned so much, like 10x what I learned in those first 5 years. I mean, those first 5 years were a great foundation. But then, you know, you learn about all the key vendors, like all the key players in personal injury. Who do you use for settlements? Who do you use for, you know, lien resolution? Who do you use for marketing vendors? Like, there's very key players in personal injury that a lot of people don't realize. And if you're really deep in the industry, you know who are the serious people and who are people that you might not want to work with. And then, you know, one day after all this coaching for years and years, and I'm still in coaching, I started joining masterminds. And masterminds are like when groups get together and they just share their best ideas. So it'd be like 12 law firms, and everybody shares like their key things they're doing currently that's the best and the worst. And so that became like a huge source of learning for me. And I'm in like a bunch of masterminds now. And then I started taking my team and getting my team to get coached by other people's teams, because you can take your firm so far, but if your team is not getting the same level of coaching as you as the owner, there starts to become a big gap. So then I went on a journey of doing mindset coaching. And that was a whole nother kind of detour. But honestly, the underpinnings to any successful business is the mindset of the owner. And we all have limiting beliefs. And you have to attack those beliefs to really break through certain financial set points. So as I'm doing all this, I start getting emails from people and they're like, will you coach me? And I'm like, I secretly really did want to coach people. I think that was why I was so drawn to coaching. But you have this like imposter syndrome where you always feel like, well, I'm a student, like I'm still learning. But I think the best coaches are people that are still learning and still in the game and still getting better. So I just said, yeah, sure. Like, this is super casual. I'll just do the best I can. I'll coach you. And I kind of on the side started coaching like 12 law firms. One led to another, led to another. And they started having like really transformative results. Like, one person I was coaching, their revenue was like $250,000. And then the next year it was $850,000. And so like, I was starting to like see the coaching was really like blowing up. And people were like coming to me and saying like, you've changed my life. I had one person like say like, you saved my life. And I was like, dang, like, like, I didn't realize the impact I was having. And it was like really, really rewarding experience to help someone avoid the pitfalls that I've made, you know, the mistakes I've made in my business. And so, yeah, it's just kind of taken on a life of its own. And then this year, after 18 months of doing that, we were like, we think we're going to publicly announce that we've been doing this because we've kind of just been doing it as a side hustle. And then that created its own, you know, energy. So now, yeah, this is what I've been doing.
Well, everyone needs a coach, whether it's someone that's helping you get better in athletics. I know when I was competing as a cyclist, you know, always had coaching because helping someone who evaluates your data, sees it from another perspective in that performance realm is incredibly impactful. Same thing in business. And I think now there's a shift in mindset, and you're a good example of that. Younger lawyers who are treating their practices a little bit more like the formality around most businesses instead of the law practice. Not that it's still the practice of law, but it's also a business and looking at the metrics and looking at performance and looking at profitability, looking at efficiency, looking at, you know, your scoreboard. What does that look like? Those things are so impactful, but then having that coach who can help you really evaluate that data with a different eye. So
I think the discussion in our community that it's either a practice or a run like a business is kind of a misnomer in a sense, because I mean, if you think about it, if you want to run a great trial team, you need to be good at managing your money. You need to be good at hiring and recruiting. You need to be good at retaining talent. You need to be good at technology and bringing in the best tools for your team. Like, this idea that I can have a good trial law firm and not be good at business is actually a myth. The best litigation firms in this country are run like well-oiled machines. And the bottom line is the number one reason people are disbarred is typically not really a legal issue. It's a mismanagement of their law firm issue. Even if you miss a statute of limitations, it's probably because you don't have the proper systems in your firm. It's not likely because you're a bad lawyer. And we've got to like really get people to understand, if you open a law firm, you have a duty to run a well-oiled machine for your staff and for their bar licenses and for your clients. You think a client wants to have a firm represent them that everything in the firm is disorganized and a wreck? No. You think they want to hire a law firm if they knew that your like unable to hire good talent, like you're a better law firm if you're really savvy at business.
But sometimes I think what gets missed is there are some great trial lawyers who maybe don't go, oh, well, my skill set isn't being the CEO of my firm. I really need someone in that role or someone sitting in the COO role or firm administrator, you know, some powerful forces within the firm that can do the things that you may not be good at. Because like all of us, we have certain skill sets and gifts. And, you know, I know in my own business, I've tried to make sure the people that are in the seats are, you know, making sure my blind spots are covered, just like any other leader needs to have those people in place to make sure that things run the right way.
Yeah, I mean, if you're an amazing trial lawyer, you can find somebody that can fill that role. But if you are the owner, you have the duty to fill that role, whether it be you or somebody else.
Yeah, that's the thing. I wanted to ask you about Tiger Tactics, the CEO edition, because you're a co-author, contributor, and there was something on social media that I came across that you were talking about rapid growth being the answer to solving problems, that the problems of a small firm are just different from the problems that you experience yeah. during growth, and departments of one being much more risky because of when one fails, you got to step in and take control and divert your
focus. Have you experienced that in your entrepreneurial journey?
Yeah, all of that. So that's what really piqued my interest, and the idea that, you know, the efficiency in building these things is what enables you to handle the bigger cases with less risk. So what is your advice that comes from all of that? Because I thought it was a really, really interesting insight into what happens as you scale.
So as you know, the worst number in business is one. And the reason why that is that you have no cross-training, no backup. You know, I can't tell you how many times when you lose somebody in a certain seat and then, you know, now suddenly it's on my plate and you want to have some diversification, some spread risk. I mean, people can have to quit. They can get sick. They can get hurt. They can have to move. There's a lot of good reasons why people, even if they're fabulous, can have to leave a job. And, you know, if you only have one person, you may not have anyone trained as a backup. So my goal was like, I want stability in my firm, and to have a level of stability that I really wanted, I had to have the firm be at least this size. Because you can't have two lawyers unless you have two lawyers' volume of work. But my life was horrible when I had one lawyer working for me, because psychologically, you also kind of know that you don't want to like come down on them hard when they show up late to work, because they're your only lawyer and they kind of have leverage over you. And I know this is kind of like taboo to say, but when you have 10 lawyers working there, if one leaves or one is not meeting the standards of the firm and you say, you know what, we're going to redistribute your caseload to the other 9 lawyers, you know, life goes on. If you have one lawyer and you're about to go on a family vacation and this person acts a fool, you're like, dang, I have to fire this person, but I'm going to have to cancel my family vacation. You know, and I think we've all been there. You're shaking your head. I know you've been there. I can see the pain in your eyes. So, you know, if you don't want to have your life be in a constant state of firefighting, you need to have a larger firm that has more diversified spread risk, more people, more cross-training. And then what I found when I got to that level is it's way more fun to run a bigger firm because you have higher caliber candidates. I hate to say this, but A players want to work at A companies. It's easier to recruit. People are more clear on your message when you're a bigger firm and like what you really stand for and what you're trying to build. And then people that work for you have a better quality of life, because when you have one person go down and you have a very small firm, it like weighs on everyone else. So like suddenly, you know, somebody else has to take on all this extra work. So I was always thinking, like, I could give my team a better quality of life if they all had support and backups. And so then you get a better culture and you get people that are more happy in their career because they're not burned to a crisp. You know, I mean, I remember years in the beginning of my law firm where people were just burned to a crisp because there was so much work and we didn't have enough manpower, and you lose one out of four people, it pours a ton of work on everyone else and nobody could ever go on vacation. That was like one of our driving things, is like nobody could have a quality of life. No one could go on vacation. Now we should have a firm where people can take a week vacation and they don't come back to a nightmare. And then beyond that, when you have like a team of lawyers like I have now, and I want to expand my team even further, but we sit down as a team and we roundtable cases and we get the power of everyone, especially some of the senior lawyers that can coach up some of the junior lawyers. And I think some of our legal strategy is more advanced than if it was just me and an associate. It's the power of the mastermind.
Yeah, it's such a great point, because even though as you scale and grow, problems become more complex, you also have more horsepower on the team to help solve those problems and help you continue to move forward. I'm curious, though, with as quickly as you've scaled your firm and built it, what strategies have you employed to make sure that you've got a strong, cohesive team that aligns with your vision and values to make sure that everyone's working towards your common goals?
We've made a lot of mistakes. Like, it's messy. Like, building a fast-paced firm is messy. I mean, you're going to break a lot of eggs. You're going to hire a lot of the wrong people and hopefully get them out of there quickly. In the very beginning, I didn't understand hiring. I wasn't good at hiring. I thought everyone was going to be a star. I was very naive. I think when you're self-motivated, it's very confusing why you have to motivate other people. I didn't know how to be a leader. I was perpetually disappointed by people. Why won't people work 12 hours a day? You know, like these are all like things that you have to come to terms with. Now I'm very aware of like how to spot top talent. I'm much more aware of what drives people. I'm much more aware of red flags in hiring. I'm more attuned to what it really takes to fully onboard someone and train them and the amount of time that really takes. So I don't have unrealistic expectations. I used to hire people and think they're going to be productive the second week. You know, that's a really big mistake. I'm also really much more aware of the correct KPIs to hold people accountable to. Like in the beginning, you're creating KPIs and maybe some of my original KPIs were not realistic. Now I feel like I have clear view on what is the proper production for each role and how much someone should be able to do. And so I have standardization on that, where in the beginning, you're kind of just making that up. Through all these little pain points, my thought was like, I never want to deal with that again. I need to get better. So like, okay, I'm not that good at hiring. How can I take my energy and spend it in a way where I could get 100% better at hiring? And I would become obsessed with that. Or, okay, we're not that good at leadership. What can we do to become better leaders? And like, I would spend 6 months just like obsessing over that. Or, hey, we need mid-level managers. Like, we don't have any and we keep screwing this up. Like, where I've gotten is because I ran into like a major pain point. And my feeling is like, I don't want to deal with this perpetually. We need to figure this out.
Yeah, I think that's generally what happens. Yeah, unfortunately, pain points help you uncover solutions that avoid those in the future, but there's always another pain point to address, seems like anyway. I don't know about it. Yeah,
you're signing up. You're signing up to be a professional problem solver if you have a business. Like, let nobody think that's – like, I think there's this glamorization of being a business owner right now. And this is not for everyone. I mean, you are signing up to be in a knife fight for the rest of your life. You know?
Yeah, no doubt about it. You know, one of the things that I've seen you do masterfully, being tuned into the LinkedIn marketplace, is use your personal branding and marketing very successfully in that forum. I'm curious, in today's very competitive landscape in personal injury law, how important do you think that personal branding is for trial lawyers, and what marketing strategies have you found most effective in establishing your brand and attracting ultimately clients to your firm?
Yeah, I mean, I think branding is really important. And at the end of the day, everyone always talks about it's a competitive landscape and this and that, but nobody is you. Nobody is me. And I'm really good at being me. So nobody can compete on me, like with me on that issue. And so I just decided, like, what is the Jen Gore perspective on personal injury law? And everybody should have their own unique signature or spin on the law. And I really don't think a ton about what other people are doing. I just try to focus on what I think and, like, my version of reality in this. And, you know, there's going to be people that love your content and there's going to be people that don't love it. But if you're authentic, I think it's clear. And people are drawn to people that are authentic. And if you can get into that space, people will want to follow what you're doing.
Yeah, that genuineness, authenticness comes out in your brand if you're doing it the right way, if you're being you and not trying to be someone else. And that's why I asked the question, because I think that, unfortunately, you see a little bit of copycatness and sameness.
Well, you know, all art, you can see, like, we will get ideas and we'll be like, what's our, like, all art is imitation in some way, right? Like,
sure.
It's like, put your own spin on it. But if it doesn't feel genuine, if you're just doing something without putting your own spin on it, I don't think it works.
I wanted to ask you, you know, because you've created this very successful female-led trial lawyer firm and you've got this experience, if you had to at all navigate challenges specific to being a woman in the trial law area.
You know, I'm probably the most taboo person to answer this, because this is like my speech. I'm asked this question quite frequently. And I think it goes back to my childhood with my dad. And my dad always told me, like, you can do anything in the world. I'm disappointed you're not the president right now. Why are you not an Olympian? Like, my dad just told me my whole life I could do anything. And this is a really important message, I think, for anyone who has a daughter. And I speak to my kids this way too. And so it never really dawned on me my whole life that being a woman would have been a barrier for me. I know that's kind of, like, hard to believe, but it's really my truth. And it was instilled in me at such a young age. And, you know, my parents had me in ballet and pageants, and I was always, like, on stage and stuff. And I think that had an effect, because whenever I couldn't do something or something didn't go my way, I never thought it was because I was a woman. I just thought it's because I wasn't trying hard enough. And I really think it's important for women to take that viewpoint. And I'm not saying that there are not situations where that is not a factor, but your belief around this has a very big impact on your life. You know, I just have basically, in some bizarre way, rejected that as a reality for me. And so I show up to rooms. You'll see me on LinkedIn in boardrooms where I'm the only woman. I'm very comfortable around men. I will show up. I will challenge you. I will ask you, what are you doing? I don't care if your firm's 10 times bigger than mine. I have questions. I am not intimidated by being in rooms with men. I think because my dad always had me around his friends that were entrepreneurs and was always around lots of, you know, men talking business. So I don't want to say that this is not an issue, because I think that would be insensitive, but the way that I've, like, kind of coped with it is that I just completely reject it. And it's working for me, I feel, because I feel embraced and welcome. That's another thing with the mindset work. I have like stickies. Like I have this one right here. I don't know if you can read it, but it says it's backwards, but it says, I create my experience. And I really truly believe that we create our experiences. And I'm afraid if I would ever engage into the concept that being a woman has been a limiter for me, that I would then find that everywhere. So I just have basically been like, I'm not accepting that as a reality for myself. I find I'm embraced and loved, and people love that I'm a woman in the industry, and that's my reality that I choose to live in.
You know, look, that's you, and that's how you've approached it. But I'm curious now, that makes me wonder, as a business coach and a successful entrepreneur, then what advice would you give to...
Control your mind, control your reality, control your expectations. Everything you think about, you will get. So the moment I have a thought that is limiting, I immediately take that out. And I find that your energy commands the way people interact with you. So how you show up, how confident you are, how you, if you feel you belong, that plays a part. You know, I've had men say bizarre things to me. I don't buy into it. I don't give them my energy. I move on. Like, I'm very cautious of getting involved in things that are going to be a bad use of my energy. And, you know, there's been people over the years that send me letters like, "Dear sirs, I hope you're hiring." I'm like, well, that was an assumption that was wrong. The other thing I would say, being a woman, it's actually my like unique strength, right? Because it makes me stand out, and what makes you stand out makes you more marketable. And in a very distracted space, I think it's actually harder sometimes for just like a white guy in a legal world to stand out, because I'm unique. I'm different. So I invite people to think about whatever is making you unique, whether you have a disability or your gender or your race or something that happened to you. That could actually be your judo move. Like, why are you making it a negative? Like, I think I've leveraged being a woman as like, it's my greatest strength. I get in rooms, people are vulnerable with me, people trust women. I just focus on all the good things it is.
It's funny, because that's exactly what I was going to ask you, is how can women leverage their unique strengths to excel in the field? And you answered it. It's funny too, because I just saw, I can't remember where I saw it. It was a clip of Simon Sinek talking about women make better CEOs than men. And I really got what he was saying, because he said when he worked with men, men would always say, well, prove this to me. Show me the stats on this. Whereas a woman would approach it from a more impactful and feeling and understanding way. And, you know, I do think that there is definitely something to that, because I think – maybe I'll offend some of the male listeners, but...
Well, I just think that there is a place for everyone, and everyone has a unique point of view to offer. And whatever your viewpoint is, it's important to add that to the conversation to the legal space. Like, we need diversity in the legal space. There's lots of diverse people that we represent as lawyers. There should be diverse representation. And I also am not like a person that hates men. I love men. So, like I explained, most of my mentors have been men. There is the power of the king. There's the power of the queen. They're different energies, and they're both 100% valid and important. And I also am not a woman that goes around trying to disempower men. That's another thing I'm really on right now. I think truly powerful women do never have to disempower a man.
Absolutely. And I think exactly what you said is right. It can be additive, complementary, and
complementary. It's a great term. Yeah. And, you know, like, just the main message is, whoever you are, embrace that and own it and find the unique gifts and strengths in that.
And that's one of the things I've tried to do with our own leadership team, is really make sure that everybody is able to use their unique gifts and their contributions, because that creating the power of the collective is much more powerful. And that diversity is part of what creates a really powerful team, because those differing perspectives and experiences brings different dimensions to the decision-making process that are so critical to ultimately getting to the best possible solutions.
Yeah, yeah. I think all of this is personal development at its heart.
Yeah, for sure. So taking up a lot of your time already, last question, and I always ask it. I meant to tell you before we got started so you might think about it, but so now I'll just put you on the spot instead.
Yeah, I love it. I'm open book.
Yeah, the podcast is called Trial or Review, so I always ask a very open-ended question, and you can answer it however you want. What's your view as a trial lawyer?
I think the right to have access to a trial is so critical for our legal structure and our foundation, and we are guarding that. And, you know, it's sad in personal injury that so few cases actually get to a full trial. And, you know, we do find that law firms are getting better results the more they can get cases to trial. So I just commend that all the work that the trial lawyers across our country are doing and committed to doing. This is not easy work, but yet so needed to preserve our entire justice system. Because, you know, when it comes to bad products being made, negligence of others, we are the police force on the civil side for bad actors.
Yeah, and having been through it like you and having seen the whole inner workings of that, you know, once you've been injured, you realize how critically important, even if you knew it was important before, having that someone that is there for you throughout that process is so important personally, but then the greater impact on society, particularly with products and medical mistakes and some of these other things, you know.
Medical defective products, gosh, it's so terrible. And I think that with the type of country we have with capitalism, we really play a critical part to keeping the public safe.
Yeah, absolutely. Jennifer, it's been great to have you on the podcast. If anyone listening wants to co-counsel with you, refer a case because they've got a case going on in your neck of the woods or is interested in coaching, what's the best way to get in touch with you?
My email is jennifer@atlinjurylawgroup.com and love to connect and talk to anybody. Open book, email me.
Well, you certainly were great to talk to you, and we'll make sure to include your contact information in the show notes for today's episode. Again, appreciate all the time that you've given. The gift of time is always a beautiful thing, so thank you, and we'll see everybody on the next episode of Trial Lawyer Review.
Thank you.
This was another episode of Trial Lawyer View. We hope you enjoy today's guest and discussion. Tune in to our next episode for more helpful insights from fellow trial lawyers and practice experts. This podcast is brought to you by Synergy. Visit partnerwithsynergy.com to learn more about how Synergy can free your firm to focus on what it does best.